to the Auto Stress Watch podcast. I'm your host and producer, Nick Patel, a songwriter, publisher, and music professional. Alongside me have David Lowry and Chris Castle. David Lowry is a platinum-selling songwriter and performer for the bands Cracker and Kemper van Beethoven. He currently lectures music business students at the University of Georgia and is an ongoing artist rights activist. Chris Castle is a music lawyer in Austin, Texas, where he represents artists and music tech companies and works on public policy issues for artist rights. So this episode is actually a bonus episode for Series 1. This was initially recorded for Series 2, but Series 2 has kind of taken its own direction and overall purpose. So I'm putting this as a bonus episode for Series 1. Kind of goes more deeper into the weeds of the music industry. And specifically for today, we are talking about Facebook. And Facebook has been in the news lately. Not just that all their services shut down for several hours not too long ago, but also the rise of a whistleblower. Said whistleblower says that Facebook are operating in the shadows, prioritizing higher profits and neglecting user safety. A quote from this whistleblower is that the company's leadership knows how to make Facebook and Instagram safer, but won't make necessary changes because they have put their astronomical profits before people. She also continuously accuses Facebook of harming children and severely affecting the mental health of teens, at which Facebook knew Instagram was unsafe in this respect. She secretly copied tens of thousands of documents about Facebook's internal research before leaving the company. The documents show the identification and acknowledgement of Facebook's flaws by its researchers, and the company never addressed them. Facebook's problems are known inside the company, up to the CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, himself. And we will be sort of briefly talking about this, but also we're going to be coming back and relating it to the music industry, because obviously that's what this podcast is all about. And in the music industry, Facebook have made the excuse that they don't control their platform, and that's why they don't license properly. And due to this coming out of the Facebook whistleblower, there are some interesting things to note. So I'm going to gear over towards David and Chris and to the Zoom call. David and Chris will first start in talking to us about the interesting things that have come out in recent events with Facebook.
Yeah, well, normally this isn't like exactly in our wheelhouse as far as, you know, what we normally talk about. We usually, when we're dealing with Facebook, you know, we're thinking about how music gets on there and how it might or might not be licensed. But, I mean, really, in a way, this is the same issue. They have this platform, and it's largely it's an ungoverned space, you know? it's a failed state, as it were, right, Chris? Something like that.
Kind of like the chop.
Oh, in Seattle, yeah. It's a no law zone or something, right?
Yeah, temporary autonomous zone is the technical phrase. Well, yeah, and her whistleblowing kind of came in a couple of different flavors. One was when you drill down on it, that they're censoring, but they're not censoring enough to suit her, right? So there's some people who have a real issue with that. Particularly the people who are on the receiving end of the censorship as it exists.
Well, what Chris means is some of the conservative publications and stuff like that. Use Facebook as part of their business model are worried that really they're coming after them. On the other hand,
which they did.
Right. On the other hand, they have a point. But there's also so much of what goes on Facebook just is kind of licensed, kind of not, at least when it comes to music. So maybe right. We should talk about
it. On the licensing side, Facebook did not have any licenses for years. Facebook is one of those internet stories that's kind of like that line in the Guy Forsythe song, "Americans are freedom-loving people and nothing says freedom like getting away with it," right? And so they had for years gotten away with it. I mean, years, 12 years. They were before they got their first license. And then what they did was what a lot of these companies do is that they write a check, which seems big to us, because we don't make anything like the kind of money that they make. But it's really chump change to them. I mean, you know, there's rumors that some of the label deals they did were $150 million, right? Some of which was a penalty and some of which was a go-forward license. But, you know, to them, even if they had to pay that to all three majors, that's, you know, it's not something they want to pay particularly, but it's less than $500 million, which they'll probably make by the time you finish listening to this podcast, right? So it's not a, you know, and when you consider that they didn't have to pay any of that money for 10 or 12 years while they grew their platform, it's really chump change, right? But, you know, it's better than nothing. And now there's at least a fig leaf of a license that covers Facebook and Instagram, not WhatsApp. And of course, everyone's aware of how much WhatsApp is used for piracy, for file sharing. But
maybe,
one step at a time.
Yeah. Well, maybe we should actually talk about that. I think, Nick, you have a...
I think you
want to phrase it.
So. Yeah. Well, we can dive into Instagram and Facebook, Instagram and WhatsApp a little bit more in depth, but I did want to also touch on what it's like on other platforms like Twitter or Amazon. I know Snapchat has also gotten a little bit into the music licensing game. My only knowledge of this is from using like DistroKid. They allow you to pick Snapchat, but it has like a little beta thing next to it. Also, side note, before we get into the content ID, there's an update on Twitch that I wanted to just kind of put out there. We don't have to go deep into it, but there will be an article in the show notes if you do want to check it out a little bit further. But they recently made a deal with NMPA, which still doesn't mean that the streamers are allowed to play like Spotify or anything like that, but it basically just makes the repercussions a little looser. So instead of striking down the account, Twitch will basically just make a warning, and then Twitch will remove the videos and the clips from the platform. But it supposedly is helping music rights owners flag users more easily. But that was just a quick little side note on what Twitch is doing from one of our first episodes of last season. But anyway, I want to bring it back to Twitter and Amazon. And maybe if you know anything about Snapchat, what are some of the contents over there?
Well, Twitter is not licensed. So that's a short discussion. You know.
Yeah, Twitter is basically completely Wild West, right? I mean, they just, you go to the DMCA form and report the tweet if it has your video and music and stuff in it and you don't want it on there, right? That's all there is. There is nothing like what YouTube has, a content ID system, which isn't great, but at least it's some sort of system. Twitter has nothing. What about what's Amazon?
Well, Amazon sort of depends on which part of Amazon you're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. Amazon Music, the music service, is fully licensed. You know, I mean, I'm sure we could probably find some loopholes in there, but let's just say they're as licensed as any of them are. And, you know, Amazon, the physical retailer, has its problems with selling counterfeit discs and counterfeit stuff in general. It's not just music. But they do have distribution deals with everybody. You know, they're a major account, obviously, and have been for a long time. So, and then there's Twitch, you know, which for some reason, the knowledge of licensing within Amazon seems to stop when you get to Twitch, which I find very strange. But some of these things grew by acquisition. And, you know, the culture is different outside the mothership, you know, so we'll see. But what was funny was that Jeff Bezos basically pled ignorance that he Twitch infringing? No, is that happening? No, we can. I know what I read in the paper. You know, I mean, I don't really know anything more. You know, so he's kind of.
Are you referring to, was that his testimony or something like that?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, testimony, yeah, he like that.
Unsatisfactory. Yeah, definitely unsatisfactory. But you know, the problem that you have with all these deals that involve these platforms that don't really have any control. I mean, one thing that's common to all of these platforms, aside from the Amazon Music service, right? I mean, but say Twitch, Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, all of them are not really set up to track usage, because the way we typically license music is we say, okay, if you use it, you can only use it this way. And if you use it that way, then you need to tell us how many times it was used. And then we come up with a rate that's based on usage. So if you use it a lot, then you pay more. If you use it less, you pay less. And if you don't use it at all, then you don't pay anything. And sometimes we have a minimum guarantee, which is kind of like a insurance policy that whatever happens, I'm going to make, you know, X number of dollars for the trouble of doing the license. And you're going to account to me so that I have an idea about what is going on your platform. That's the basic stuff. And none of these people can really do it. I mean, Facebook will tell you, you know, they'll talk about PEX, they'll talk about, you know, their version of Content ID, which is some kind of audio fingerprinting technology that supposedly is tied into some kind of reporting structure. From what I've heard, it's pretty weak sauce. And they don't, because they don't control it on the front end, which is different than YouTube. I mean, YouTube does have the ability to control what gets up on their platform. They just choose not to exercise that control. And they have up to a point. I mean, you know, that's a bit unfair. They're better at it today than they were 10 years ago, but it's still not perfect. And one might say by design is not perfect. But there's a problem when you have the fundamental control that would lead to being able to track things on your system that's missing. So what ends up happening is they pay a big check to somebody, and then and then that somebody is supposed to turn around and share that check with the artists or the songwriters or the publishers, right? And whether they do or not remains to be seen, because what ends up happening a lot is that those kinds of lump sum payments that don't have particularly satisfactory tracking associated with them end up getting divided up on a market share basis. And that, of course, is the rich get richer, right? So I don't know if it would really make a whole heck of a lot of difference to some people, but you've at least got a shot, you know, at it making some difference. And of the people who do get paid, right, of the publishers who do get paid, let's say, you have a much more likely chance of having that money find its way to the right person. So just because you know that publisher X publishes a song doesn't necessarily mean that you know whether publisher X has the ability to account to their writers, you know, whether you've given them enough information to account to their writers, which is kind of the point, right? So when you hear about these deals, when they say the National Music Publishers Association, for example, not to cast aspersions, but you know, the National Music Publishers Association does not own any copyrights. The National Music Publishers Association is a lobbying group. It's a trade group, you know, and they do these deals. And I don't know why anyone would make a deal directly with a trade group for copyrights they don't own, with reporting that they're not going to receive and advances that they're not going to disperse, right?
My understanding of the way those settlements work is those settlements come in, and then the publishers have to opt into them. And there's like terms to that, and then they get some money out of it. But yeah, it's kind of actually, I mean, you got to give the NMPA some credit for, I mean, they're basically like selling a settlement that's just sort of the framework of a settlement that nobody has necessarily opted into yet. That's my understanding of it, right? So that's one of the problems with this sort of licensing. So basically, Facebook does have something like Contact ID. I think you called it PEX. Is that what you?
Yeah, they have. I think they have a proprietary tool.
Okay. So Facebook does have some way of, like, basically fingerprinting music that goes up onto their platform, and
it's called Facebook Rights Manager.
Mm-hmm. Facebook Rights Manager, and identify it, and in theory, money would go towards, I never say to, towards the artist and songwriter. That is, it may That's go right. to their the parent company of their record label, or it may go to the administrator for their publishing company or something like that. By the way, that's my dog in the background. Nobody's getting hurt. Just big dog and makes lots of noises when she plays. So there's something going on Facebook. Nick, do you have a question for us?
I do, but I also want to also introduce a different thing that we haven't talked about is what do you two think about the way TikTok does their content ID? Because you have sounds, aka just music. Anyone can have a sound onto TikTok. And again, in my example, DistroKid or any distributor, to my knowledge, you just pick the little tick button and eventually your music will be onto TikTok. But also TikTok have a counter on there. I don't know how accurate it is, but it has a counter that says how many times the sound has been used. As I guess an identifier to have a popularity element to it. But what do you guys think of the content ID there?
I don't know that there's actually content ID on TikTok. I don't actually think there is. When I've discovered my music on there, it's because it's in the sounds tab on TikTok. So if you're about to make a video, right, you want to make a video, one of the things you can do is go over to the tab for sounds and select music. So I have a number of songs that are on there. I have no idea how they got on there. They don't have any licenses with me. They may have a license with my record label, but I don't think so. And certainly they don't have rights for the underlying composition. So as far as I know, TikTok does not have any content ID. And I think
they do have PEX. Okay. Yeah, they have PEX. But okay. But remember what content, the thing that makes content ID more powerful is that it's connected to their content management system, right? And people have spent a lot of time updating the content management system on YouTube to reflect different ownership shares. There's payment implementation in the background, right? There's an accounting system. I'm not aware that the PEX uses a dubstep in part for this purpose, and I think they've got the identification thing down pretty well. But remember, with any kind of audio fingerprinting tool, it's only as good as the reference file, right? Because what it's doing is it's going out, it's capturing, and they all do some version of this. They may do it in more complex way, they may do it in a more sophisticated way, but it's all basically the same thing. They go out and they find something in the wild, like on TikTok, some video. They capture the sound in the video, in the soundtrack of the video. They then compare that to reference files in their database. And they do this all very quickly. And if they find it, then they have a match, right? But just like with Content ID, you know, there's lots of people who go around trying to defeat Content ID because Content ID will stop you from uploading onto YouTube, right? And so there's people want to upload, so they find ways to get around Content ID, like with PitchBend, where they changed the range, the key, let's say, of the song that's being performed, or the speed, the beats per minute, that the song or the recording of the song is played at. And then sometimes Content ID will miss that. It's a little more forgiving now than it was, say, 10 years ago, but it's but they do miss stuff that have been doctored like that. So, you know, when we talk about PEX or whoever it is, it's all fine technology. It's all well done. And this all happens at a very high rate of speed and at scale, but you know, it's still only as good as the reference file. So they're not going to catch everything.
And let me just say this. I wasn't aware that there was a Content ID type system on TikTok now. It didn't, a year ago, I don't think it was there. Okay. But the problem with TikTok more is that they themselves offer sounds that are not fully licensed. I know this because mine are not fully licensed. And I imagine there's a lot of other songwriters and indie publishers out there who don't have licenses as well. And then just in general, what they do pay out is obscenely small. I mean, just ridiculously small, you know? So that's a whole another topic here.
Right. Well, and that's, you know, the TikTok deal is an example of one of these deals where they write a big check up front and then nothing happens. By the time it gets down to the individual creator, it's a trickle, right? And, but if you're, you know, if you have a big catalog, you get, even if you split it 50-50 with your artist or writer, you know, they're only getting their songs or their recordings compensated, and you're getting the other side of millions of tracks, right? So it's a lucrative business for people who have big catalogs, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the artists are making money. And then that's what makes it disingenuous when people like Facebook and Spotify say, well, we pay billions of dollars to the rights holders, you know, and it's not our fault that it doesn't get to the artist, right?
To then take it to Instagram, which is more closely correlated to Facebook because they're owned by Facebook. When you post like a story to your profile, you can also attach a song, whatever section of the song you want. You can also display the lyrics of the song as they are being played in the audio. Surely that must be licensed.
Well, that's part of these global rights deals that they've made. But David, have you ever been paid for any of that stuff?
I have never been paid for anything from Instagram. I've never seen it on any royalty statement. But truthfully, I haven't checked to see if any of my works are up there, by the way.
Yeah, it's hard to know, you know, exactly where any of this money ends up, because you're relying on so many people in between to catch the uses and report on the uses. And the thing to remember is that when they announce these deals, well, you know, we've signed this with the major labels, or we've done this with, you know, Merlin or something, which is the indie label licensing group. Yeah, maybe that covers everything, but they don't make any effort to stop things that aren't in their licenses from getting posted. This is what I keep coming back to about the whole system was built in a get away with it, you know, beg forgiveness structure. than it was designed to make sure that things which are not licensed don't get up there. And this is what it comes down to on all these things. And I've always, like Spotify would say, like in David's experiences with the class action, you know, Spotify would say things like, well, we're given these tracks by the labels and we may have the obligation to clear the publishing, but we don't know who to call. There's no central database, right, of information. And if we just had a central database, then we'd be happy to do it. It's like, well, you know, there's another way to do that, right? Which is what we used to do at the record company when I worked at A&M. You know, we would tell the producers, when you deliver that record, you need to give us all the metadata, all what we would now call metadata, you know, all the publisher information, all the writers, all the splits, right? All of that. Or you haven't delivered the record and you won't get paid your back end, right? And guess what? That policy produced.
I know that because you got all of it, because I know that because I have, as a producer, often was waiting on my last third of my payment because some manager hadn't found, you know, hadn't got the band to decide how they were splitting the songs and who wrote it and who did some, did their friend really write this song, part of the song or not? You know what I mean? Like that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
But you know what? It produced the information because people would say, well, the information. The band hasn't decided yet what the splits are. I said, well, that's great. I've got time. Let them go have a meeting and we'll just wait. and by the way, remind them that just like you, producer, haven't delivered your record, they haven't delivered their record either, and they're not getting their back end. So maybe that could help speed things along, you know? And sure enough, it did. And you know what ended up happening was you hear about this black box, like with the MLC's got $424 million of black box payment from the services. What ends up happening is that if you have that policy up front, as we did at A&M, when you get to the 2 or 3 year mark where you get audited by the Harry Fox agency, you don't have anywhere near the unmatched that the other labels had. And we used to get, when we'd get audited by Harry Fox, they would come in, they'd say, you're unmatched is like $25,000 for 3 years, you know? And I would say, that's right. And they'd say, that can't be that, you know, everybody else's is in the millions. Yours is $25,000. I said, yeah, well, you know, we clear it. And they would be furious because what happens when the black box payment gets paid over in an audit is all kinds of things happen because it's not allocated, right? It just goes into another black box pot, this time at the Harry Fox agency, just like this $424 million went into a pot at the MLC. It's the same thing, you know, and no one, it wasn't allocated when it got paid and it still isn't allocated. It's been sitting there since April. And I think it's going to be sitting there for years to come. Right. Whereas if you just taken the time to match it before you put the track up on Spotify, for example, and Spotify's in control of that, they could very easily just say to that product manager from Atlantic Records, you know what? I'm not putting your track up because I don't have the publishing. So, you know, if you can get me the publishing, that'd be great. I'll put it up right away. Guess what? They would have that information immediately, right? Because the product manager would say, oh, no, you don't. I've got to then tell my boss why my track's not up on Spotify and so on and so on and so on, right? And it becomes, you can see, if you put the rule in the right place at the right time, it produces the right piece of information pretty much consistently, right? But if they don't, if they come into this without ever caring about what's on their platform, and this goes to your point about they say they don't know, they don't try to know, you know. It's amazing what you can't find if you don't look for it, you know.
Just to speak to your point, what's interesting to me through my work is that there's such a backlog of unidentified and unmatched works. Now, I work in mechanicals and it's not streaming mechanicals. That's a different department, but just to give an idea that like there are a lot of things that aren't identified. There are a lot of stakeholders and publishers that aren't identified for works that have been released in like 2019, which is crazy. And they don't get paid for their mechanicals until we approve them and that we verify everything that we can. Look at the agreements, see how much they're supposed to be getting, and all of that. So there's a ton of pending and unmatched stuff. Even at the label side, there's so much stuff.
But the reason there's so much stuff is because people put it out. There wouldn't be no earnings if they didn't put it out without knowing what it was. That's my point. There's another side to that, which is, look, it's a big ship and commerce must be done. And you know, we can't let the recording suffer at the hands of the song. And, you know, I've heard all these excuses, right? But what I know is that when we made that rule at A&M and we told the first couple of months, it was sort of touch and go because it was new, you know. But once people knew that that was what was going to happen, once the managers in particular got to know that that's what was going to happen, they were prepared, you know, and everything went a lot smoother. So I'm sympathetic that there's a lot out there, but I know why it's there. There's only one reason why money gets made without knowing who to pay it to. It's because you decide to generate the revenue, which means you decide to put the records out without having your licensing tied down. And they always give the example of Despacito, you know, like for some reason, there's like all these writers on Despacito and they say, well, you know, we couldn't clear them all or we'd never be able to put them out, right? Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. Tell it to the judge.
So what is the argument for WhatsApp having musical license? Because you can transmit music across the platform, but that can be said about any direct messaging app like iMessage, and surely iMessage doesn't have a musical license. And I don't know if they've necessarily been in the news like WhatsApp or Facebook have been in music licensing in regards to this, but what is there an argument, a standing argument in direct messaging?
Well, I mean, it's a little more like, I think in a way, like the big rights holders, they would like, you know, the big labels, big publishers would probably like the money. They're probably losing a lot of money from WhatsApp, but I imagine they're just hesitant because it's sort of it's a private communication, right? And so they're essentially going to be, you know, they don't want to be seen as reaching inside to people's private communications, right? However, I mean, many years ago, people would make cassettes, mixtapes, cassettes, right? All the time, pass them around and stuff like that. And what a lot of, well, like people like myself who made these mixtapes, I guess, suppose when I was in college or maybe copied some of my friends' albums or whatever I was doing, these sort of informal copying, didn't realize it, but I was essentially paying a royalty. When I bought that blank cassette, I paid, what is it called? Blank media royalty or something like that, right? And then you could sign up, if you were an artist or a publisher, I know as an artist, you could sign up for blank media royalties. And I assume it was divided up on basically a market share basis. You know, it was like, you know, this month, you know, Camper Van Beethoven was in Billboard position 482 or something like that. Maybe 205. I think we once crossed into the top 200s, right? And there would be some amount of royalty that would be due to me, right? You know, based kind of on market share that I might get. So
Perhaps WhatsApp could do something like that. Where basically it's like, we're going to assume a certain amount of music is coming through our platform. We can kind of tell from the way stuff's being compressed that these are songs or whatever like that. And, you know, if they want to, Facebook could, you know, make an earnest effort to figure out approximately what's going on in WhatsApp and then come to some sort of, you know, agreement with, I don't know, maybe like a sound exchange, something that some entity that knows has a database covering most commercially available sound recordings. And then when the MLC gets their database up, maybe they could come to an agreement with them. And from there, we could come up with some sort of licensing scheme without invading anybody's privacy. That's my thought on the issue. What do you think, Chris? Is there anything there?
Well,
they don't want to do it, you know.
Right.
And the labels don't want to do it. WhatsApp is just a messaging app. It's like iMessage, right? You could do the same thing with Apple iMessage too, right?
Yeah. The thing with WhatsApp is that if they're going to claim DMCA protection, then they have to, which is what I'm sure they're going to do, then they have to, and they do comply with DMCA from what I understand. They're a bit different than, let's say, Morpheus or, you know, the Pirate Bay or one of these, you know, real full bore piracy sites, in the sense that they're not out soliciting, they're not selling advertising, as far as I know, anyway. They're not profiting.
Well, WhatsApp's just a messaging thing.
You understand? Right, that's what I'm saying. They're different. Right. Than the typical pirate.
I don't, and they're encrypted. They say they can't even tell what is being sent from one user to another.
But they can tell that there's a lot of traffic. I mean,
well, you can tell when something is a text message versus a 5.9 megabit file, but you know what I mean? Like they can tell that.
Right. And they can tell if a user
is probably like music or video or whatever.
But the way the DMCA works is there's something called the knowledge predicate. And this is a whole other rabbit hole to go down. So we should probably just leave it at that. But basically, if you don't know or you shouldn't have known that there's infringing activity going on your system, then you don't have, you can't be sued for, copyright infringement, you know.
So that's a heavy lift. There's just like way too many.
Yeah, because course, then there were a bunch of people who tried to make sure they didn't know anything.
Right? Yeah.
And that didn't work out either because that was so obvious. But WhatsApp and messaging apps are, you know, they have what are commonly called substantial non-infringing uses, and they don't.
Right.
You know, you don't really get. I always say there's a market clearing level of piracy. You know, that you just have to accept. Mm-hmm. You can enforce your rights. I'm not saying you should just roll over. You know, you can send your notices. You can do what you need to do to enforce your rights, but you're not ever going to kill it. And we never did kill it. I mean, there were ex-Arvin colonels out in Santa Ana, you know, who had CD duplicating plants, right? I mean, there were people in the desert, you know, they're with vinyl. You know, by the bushel. So it's not, you know, it's not like we've never had to deal with this, but it really turns on whether you knew or should have known that piracy was going on. And then if how much you were involved in it, because there, you know, there's a lot of indications that Google has been actively involved.
Well, Mega Upload, where their advertising subsidiary applied some advances or something.
Yeah. AdSense. Yeah. They had a contract with AdSense. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that's and people would always say, you mean Google was involved and was selling ads on a pirate site? Yes. That's exactly what I mean. You know, mm-hmm. And people would clutch their pearls and be surprised. Mm-hmm. But let's not go down. We can go on and on about the DMCA. Yeah. So let's. But that's
and we're that, going to talk about Facebook anyway today.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
and it's related platforms, right?
Right.
So then, now that we've sort of touched base with all of these platforms and their use or no use of music and licensing, with the failure to license, how much of it is due to this thing called super voting stock?
Well, so this is the real, this to me is the real question, right? What did the board know and when did they know it? And could the CEO have done more to influence the outcomes, right? Because, you know, they all want to try to distance this as much as possible. One of the things that we learned from the Facebook whistleblower was that the, you know, senior management of Facebook is involved in a lot of these decisions. And the one thing they never really brought out in the hearing, which, you know, no one ever seems to bring out, is why that is. Why would somebody who was the CEO of a multi-billion dollar corporation be involved in some of the decision-making that this person said Mark Zuckerberg was involved in, right? And why wouldn't the board have had more influence over it? Why couldn't other people have stepped in to stop some of these abuses, particularly, you know, when you find out that they had psychological studies, you know, of what caused, you know, what they call emotional contagion on the Facebook platform, which then sucked people in and they could sell more ads, right? Why did all that happen? Well, one of the reasons it happens is because Facebook has what I think is a pernicious type of corporate governance, which is called super voting shares, or sometimes called a dual class stock. They're not the only ones that have it. Spotify has it, Google has it, Twitter has it. WeWork had it, which was a very expensive lesson for them, in because it's hard to get rid of once you create it. And basically what super voting shares are is they say, this one person, Mark Zuckerberg, is going to have more votes than anybody else. And the way we're going to make sure that he always has more votes than anybody else is we're going to give him 10 votes for every share of stock he owns or controls. And should he ever run low on voting power because he sells off some of his stock, we're going to give him some warrants or things like warrants that will give him more votes, right, to top up his voting control. So what that means is, you know, Mark Zuckerberg has 100% control over Facebook. He can fire the board. The board knows this, right? The board knows they can get fired. And so they like being on the Facebook board. It makes them a lot of money and they feel powerful, right? And so, you know, they do what Zuckerberg says. All of the executives at Facebook, you know, basically serve at the pleasure of Zuckerberg, right? Including Sheryl Sandberg and, you know, the very senior management. So if anything is going wrong with Facebook, there's really only one person to look to, and that's the person who has done everything humanly possible to make sure that he has control over Facebook forever. And when you consider, yeah, I don't want to go down this rabbit hole, but when you consider that he's a big investor in transhumanism and the solidarity and the melding of machine and man, forever could be a very long time in his case, right? Which raises an interesting question. You know, do you have to be a human in order to exercise voting stock? But so that's really kind of the problem. So anything that is right about Facebook, he can take credit for, but anything that's wrong about Facebook, he gets the blame and he gets all the blame because at the end of the day, he controls everything in that company.
Right. And Steve, if you aren't aware of like the sort of the one stock, one vote idea. Yet first, corporations were governed in sort of the same way our democracies are, except, you know, if I have a lot of money and I own a lot of stock, I get more votes, right? But this is really, really pernicious because, see, with the old way, right, if you had a lot of votes, you also, if you made and you had a lot of control and your decisions were bad, you lost a lot of money, right? But now you have this situation where you can really have control without having a lot of stock. And so if you make some bad decisions, you don't pay quite the price that the other shareholders might, right?
That's right. And they don't have, so
the old way of having one vote, you know, per stock, share of stock, right, sort of had a way of correcting itself, right? And now, since all of these, not just technology companies, but now a lot of other companies are mimicking this, we're starting to see pretty consistently some common problems with companies that have this, you know, super majority voting or whatever, super voting stock shares, right? They're all, yeah. These problems seem really similar, right? So there's a way to fix that. I mean, you know, maybe like we should start at the root here, just in case. Seems a little weird that people can do this, you know, super majority voting stock, right? Or super voting stock, right? What is it called, actually? What's technically it's
super,
called?
Super voting stock or dual class,
right? Yeah. It seems like, you know, this is one of those things where if the, you know, the losses and the responsibility was shared out across a lot more people, you're less likely to have these problems that we're seeing, right?
That's right.
You know, it's one of the reasons why, exactly, you know, right. For instance, our, you know, our constitution just wanted to disperse power so that there wasn't really these really, you know, there weren't that many positions that had very much power. And even that would be like really limited, was just so we didn't get abuses, you know, by one person, right? It's just the damage would be limited, right? The same idea.
But on the plus side of super voting stock is that so I don't think you should do away with it altogether, but where it's been effective has been with family-owned businesses, particularly family-owned media companies that have a particular editorial point of view, right? It's a protection from those entities being taken over by somebody who's completely antithetical to their views, right?
Like a New York Times
would probably
have that. That would benefit from that kind of stock for their family,
right?
The family owned business. That's, I don't know if people know that, right?
Right, but those companies never controlled the mind meld of 5 billion people, right?
Exactly. Right. So probably what you're saying is over a certain size, market share or something like that, we should probably
What I'm saying is there's not a lot of problems with trying to figure out how best to do this, right? Mm-hmm. And the exchange, the New York Stock Exchange, for example, or the NASDAQ could just make a rule one day that we're not going to have companies with a market cap over X, you know, with super voting stock, or we're not going to have anybody who's part of the S&P 500, because remember, when these companies become part of the index, right? And David can speak to this better than I can, but when they become part of the index, their influence over the world is expanded considerably, right? Because, you know, fund managers who have to create a portfolio or a basket of stocks that mimic the index will end up buying those shares. And so there, again, you have one guy you know, whose good or bad decisions can have an effect on millions of people who may not even have Facebook accounts, right? I mean, so there, anyway, I don't want to belabor the point, but there's, I think if you start looking at the changes you could make, the little changes you could make to try to, well, it's not so little, but you're not breaking up the company. You know, you're not penalizing them. You're not changing the copyright infringement rules. You know, you're not changing the consumer protection laws in any particular way. You're not changing the DMCA or the Section 230 safe harbors, you know, but what you are doing is you're saying, okay, I'm going to make more people accountable for their bad decisions. I'm not going to have one guy be able to make bad decisions. And then if the board tries to chastise him, fire the board, which means they're never going to chastise him, right? So, you know, I think that one thing could cause a lot of, could do a lot of good, and not just Facebook, but Twitter, Spotify, Amazon, Amazon actually doesn't have this. Google, right? There's a bunch that do have this structure, because what happens, of course, is in Silicon Valley, you know, people will say, like, if Google started doing it, Google was one of the first ones that did this in a big way. LinkedIn did it also, but Google was the one that I think was probably the most successful. And then all the entrepreneurs come in and they tell their lawyers, hey, I want that deal like Google had, right? And the next thing you know, everybody's got it, right? So it's like founder dead hand control, you know? So I'm a big believer in getting rid of this super voting stock.
So to bring it towards the end of the podcast, what are some possible solutions, if you guys have thought of any, for Facebook in terms of licensing? Do you see anything changing in this respect in light of the recent events of Facebook?
Well, I mean, the fact that Facebook is under fire so much from everybody for a lot of reasons, some are good, some are bad. I'm also a little suspicious that Facebook is being thrown under the bus by the other tech companies so that they're the sacrificial, you know, they're the sacrificial lamb, so nobody comes after them, because they all have the same problems, or in a lot of ways. People have been awfully quiet on YouTube and Google lately, right? Which has all the same problems. I mean, one of the things I would love to see one of these platforms do is kind of what we did with the class action for Rhapsody Napster. There is an artist advisory board. It has no power, really, but we get to basically come up with ideas, and we have meetings with upper management. And we say, hey, we think this idea, or you should do this, or what about this? And they say, well, what about this? How would this work for artists, right? Just literally having some kind of like advisory board that, you know, once a month has 90 minutes with management, maybe music licensing management, right? I mean, I think the possibilities are endless there, right? Obviously Rhapsody Napster is a very small platform. You know, it's a very tiny snippet of the streaming market, but I think there's some interesting dialogue going along. It would be neat if Facebook did something like that for the use of music on their platforms, on Amazon. I mean, if Amazon did something like that, if Twitch did something like that, you know, that'd be neat.
And what's interesting to me about the Rhapsody board is that the, you know, it's not the NMPA and the RAA, you know, who are meeting with them. It's actual artists.
Yeah.
You know, who are working artists trying to make a living.
Working artists. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. That's the key. Mm-hmm. That's the key. Not, you know, big names who are basically acting just as an extension of, you know, the record companies, or who have to go through their managers, or, you know, are worried about how they're going to come off, or, you know, or, right. It adds a whole other dimension if you have really big stars. Right. But if you don't but if you're just a working artist, I think it's a very positive thing.
Right. And also, if you take it out of, like, I always look at these things like, how, you know, some of these outrages, like, for instance, the streaming services appealing the raise for songwriters on streaming, like with the Copyright Royalty Board, there was basically a 40% raise for songwriters, and then they appealed it, and, you know, it's gone back to the old rate. Okay, so what tiny percentage of Spotify, well, not, let's do it this way. What tiny percentage of Amazon, Apple, and Google's overall revenue they're saving such a small percentage of revenue, those three companies. It makes me wonder if anybody in upper management has any idea that this is going on, that this is being appealed, and the potential downside for these companies of, you know, bad publicity. I mean, I can't believe that there wasn't like a viral moment over the fact that Amazon, Apple, and YouTube and Spotify all cut songwriters' pay like within a couple weeks of the pandemic lockdown. I mean, how tone deaf is that, right? But they seem to have got away with it. There was no big major blowback, but there should have been, right? So just the fact that if songwriters could say something like this to, you know, executives that had some kind of control over this, they might go, oh yeah, you're right. This is such a small amount of money, and the downside for us, I mean, it just, it's big. Like, let's not do this, right? Anyway, that's what I think.
Right, yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Letters to Writers to Watch. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. If you'd like to join in on the conversation, you can add us on Twitter at Artist Rights, or on Facebook at Artist Rights Watch, or you can check out our website at artistrightswatch.com. If you missed that or you want more information on this episode, please check out the show notes for further research. We will catch you again next time where we watch for Artist Rights. Cheers.